Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother is on the other end of the line. Hi, Mom.
Hi. Hi. Keeping warm, I hope.
Yep, we're in the wintertime. It is February 2021. What an odd time. I think we'll look back at this time sometime and think, wow, we really lived through all of that.
Yeah, let's hope let's hope we can look back soon.
Yeah, that's for sure. So, of course, one of the issues that has been prominent in our country over the past year are its issues about immigration. Mm-hmm. And we have with us today two women who know a lot about that from personal experience.
Yes. The name of the book is I Dream of Popo, and it is written by Livia Blackburn, and excuse me, she wrote The Midnight Thief and Rose March Duologies. Livia was born in Taiwan and moved to Albuquerque when she was 5 after a 12-year stand at Harvard at MIT, where she earned an A.B. in biochemical sciences and a Ph.D. in cognitive neuroscience. She moved to Los Angeles, where she now lives, and wrote this lovely book. And, of course, there are pictures in a child's picture book. And so Julia Kuo is the Taiwanese-American illustrator who has worked with the New York Times, Google, and Science Friday. Julia has taught illustration courses at Columbia College, excuse me, Chicago, and at her alma mater, Washington University in St. Louis. She's the illustrator of drawing leaves and trees, observing the sketching and natural world. And this is an amazing book. It really is. And it's supposed to be a children's book, but it's a great book for grandmothers. And I'm a grandmother, so I should know, right?
That's right. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Livia and Julia.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Now, is one of you in California and one of you in somewhere else?
Yeah, I'm in Cleveland right now.
Okay, okay. And Livia, are you in California?
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles,
yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So did you know each other before you worked on this book together?
We did not, actually.
No.
But
we have mutual friends.
Yeah, it's really funny because, so we were completely introduced through our publisher, but afterwards, chatting, I think we found out that we have several mutual friends, even though we've never lived in the same city.
Yeah, I think it just says something about the Taiwanese-American community in the States.
I wondered about that. Maybe you know my daughter-in-law.
Maybe.
She lives in Austin, Texas, and she also was born in Taiwan and moved. I think she was only about 2 when her family came to Port Lavaca, Texas. I believe there's a fairly large Taiwanese community there.
Oh.
So that's pretty similar
to
our experiences then, because Julia was born here, and then I moved when I was 5, and Julia had a bit of moving back and forth too.
Oh, so you
right,
lived
yeah. So I was born here. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, so you lived in Taiwan at some points?
Yeah. My parents actually thought that they might want to move back. So when I was 4, the entire family moved back to Taipei, and we lived there for a year, and then they decided to come back to the States again. So I actually left when I was 5, which coincidentally is the same age that Livia left, too.
And do you visit Taiwan frequently? Well, not today, probably because of COVID, but
right.
You know, did your family tend to go back and visit fairly often?
My family would go back every couple years or so. It was usually, you know, limited by like our school schedules. But my parents actually moved back to Taiwan yet again to take care of their parents. And this was about 10 years ago. And it coincided with the time that I started just freelance illustrating. So I've actually gone back every single year since then, except for this year.
How do you, is it hard to adjust going back and forth, or are you just really so bilingual and so bicultural that it's easy for you?
Okay, so bicultural, yeah, pretty much so. As for the language, that's kind of a different story. As someone who was raised here and just, you know, spoke English almost all my life, it's always been a struggle to speak Mandarin well. I can listen just fine, but, you know, my Mandarin kind of sounds like the level of a second grader or a third grader. And I can tell when I go back to Taiwan that the first week it's terrible and then it slowly improves. So when I meet up with Taiwanese friends, I try to schedule it for the last week that I'm there because I know that my Mandarin will be at its best point.
And Livia, what's your experience like going back and forth?
So I used to go back more often, back when we had more relatives there. So, you know, in my childhood, we pretty much went back once a year, maybe stayed for about 2 or 3 weeks or so. And then, and nowadays we don't go back as often. I think the last time I went back was about 2 or 3 years ago for a wedding. And I'd say the hardest thing about transitioning, I think 80% of the awkwardness is language, and then maybe about 20% cultural. The hardest thing I have trouble with is I feel like if you're not incredibly good in a language, it's hard to be polite in it. So, you know, like Julie mentioned, I kind of speak like a 5-year-old. So if I'm, you know, asking people for things, or, you know, just you don't quite get that level of kind of social grace or something. And that always makes me feel a little awkward.
I never thought about that, but it's true. Yeah.
I feel very klutzy.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you only know how to say things one way, like, I'm full. But, you know, sometimes you wish you could say, like, oh, like, you know, this was so delicious, I just can't eat one more bite. But all you can say is, I'm full.
Oh, of course.
There's a lot of nuance.
Yeah.
Right. And then you look Chinese, so people don't give you the benefit of the doubt.
Yep. So, Livia, you've written mostly, I believe, for young adults. Is that accurate?
Yes. That's right. So my first 4 novels were young adult novels, young adult fantasy, so completely different. This picture book, I got into it because basically I had a daughter, and we wanted to read to her, and so we were going to the library and, you know, reading hundreds of books a year. And, you know, I just fell in love with that art form as well.
So this book is really for her.
It is. Well, you know, I'd say this book is maybe half for her and half for me, and maybe even more for me. I think she kind of inspired me, but you know, this is such a personal story, and I think it was just something inside me that it was waiting to be told. It just needed the right format to put it in.
So I dream of Popo. Who's Popo?
Yes. So Popo is the Mandarin word for maternal grandmother. And growing up in Taiwan, my maternal grandmother was one of my main caretakers. And, you know, so we were very close. And then when I moved to the United States, obviously we couldn't, be together as much. You know, we had long distance phone calls back then, went back every year. But, you know, so our relationship changed. And also, as I started losing my Chinese, it became harder to communicate with her. And so my grandmother passed away, you know, when I was a teenager. And, you know, since then, I will dream of her every once in a while. And the dreams will be about different things, but always in the dreams we'll be having really in-depth, intimate conversations in English. And that, I think, was the main spark for the book, you know, the idea of a Chinese American girl speaking to her Chinese grandmother in English.
Oh. And I know, you know, people may not all realize this, but it is quite common when you write a children's book that you aren't responsible for the illustrations at all. The publisher finds the illustrator and maybe, I mean, but how much input, how much interaction did you have with Julia in the illustration of the book?
We didn't have that much. So, yeah, it was pretty much a traditional picture book kind of process. So, you know, I knew that she was chosen. They shared some of her sample images with me, her illustrations from other books, just so I could, like, you know, give my input on that. And so, you know, I loved what I saw, and so they brought her on board. And then I didn't really see the drawings until they were pretty close to finished. And I think but at that point I asked for, I think, one big change, maybe a few small changes. The change I asked for was, so there is a flower called the Guihua that played a prominent part in the story. So I just asked her to put it in a few more spreads.
Julia, how did you become a children's book illustrator?
You know, just really quickly, I forgot that you did that, Livia. I can't even remember where I added it in. I'm like looking through the threads right now. Okay, how did I become a children's book illustrator? So I actually went to school for business, but, you know, I'd been drawing all my life, and I was like, well, I'll just take a couple art classes in school. And then they led, the couple art classes led to more and more until one day my art school actually called me in and said, you can't take any more art classes unless you switch like your degree over. And so I just did both art and business, which is funny because that is what a freelance illustrator is. You're doing art, but you're running a business at the same time. And so I think I was lucky that when I left to become a freelance children's book illustrator, I had already spent a couple years working as an illustrator for American Greetings. That was a, you know, a salary job where I was designing greeting cards. I had gained some experience, saved some money, and I was able to pursue what I was looking for. And I think one of my first projects was a book. It was a chapter book, and it was with Alvina Ling, who's an editor at Little Brown. And I think she kind of took a gamble on me and brought me on a board that a chapter book that Jenny Han had written. Jenny Han is the author who did the trilogy To All the Boys I've Loved. And I think like that connected me to my agent, who really opened the doors to book illustration for me.
I would imagine that this is not an easy field to break into.
It's very like it takes a lot of luck. I think. I mean, there is a good amount of risk taking involved, and I was privileged that, you know, I didn't have a lot of debt, student debt looming over me, and that I could kind of jump into this. I also think it was a personality thing where I felt okay with taking that gamble, but I also think I was incredibly lucky.
I'm it's interesting to hear you acknowledge that, because a lot of times people don't. You know, it's sort of like, well, I did this all myself. It was hard work and so forth. But I think in any type of success, particularly in the arts, there is an element of luck, because you see people who are extremely talented who never get anywhere in terms of trying to make a living at doing what they love. And
yeah.
So, you know, kudos to you for having achieved that.
Right. No, I do feel incredibly grateful, and I think that's why I've continued going in this path. I don't know if I had always set out to illustrate purely books. You know, I'm also interested in editorial illustration and many other forms, but I know it's so hard to get here, and I have a supportive and incredible agent, and I have kind of like these connections, and so I'm just going in this direction because I've had the good fortune of having those doors open to me.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today are Livia Blackburn and Julia Kuo, who are the author and illustrator of the children's book I Dream of Popo. Now, Livia, you didn't take a particularly direct route to becoming a writer either, did you?
No, it was incredibly roundabout. So, you know, I always knew that I loved writing. You know, as a high school student, as a even as an elementary school student, I was always reading, always writing, but kind of being the pragmatic Asian child, I went to school for science. And so I got my degree at Harvard in biochemistry, and then cognitive neuroscience at MIT was where I got my PhD. And the writing thing, so I was in it was really kind of random. So in college, I hardly did any writing at all. You know, I didn't have time to, you know, sleep, much less, you know, write or read for fun. And then one day at MIT, I was in my third year of graduate school. I was taking a class at Harvard Med, and I was waiting on the bus. I was waiting for the bus, and, you know, it's cold in Boston. There was the Harvard bookstore right next to the door to the bus stop, so I went inside, and there was a display. Actually, it was the Twilight series, and I picked it up, and I started reading, and, you know, there's something about that series that just, like, really, is really addicting, so I ended up reading the whole series over the weekend, and remembering, I know, right? So thank you, Stephanie Meyer, but that was what got me back into writing. I remembered, oh, you know, I love this. I love writing. I love, and even though I write in a different genre than she does, you know, I do fantasy instead of romance, but, you know, I love stories, and I just went back. I took an old manuscript from high school, actually, that was about, you know, I was 80 pages into that. I took the main character from that, reworked it into a new story, and that became Midnight Thief, my debut novel, which sold maybe my last year of grad school. And, you know, at that point, I had realized that I really was much more of a writer at heart than a scientist. And so I graduated and then never looked back.
So do you have any regrets about all the time and effort that you spent on that getting that education?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think about it, you know, I got a husband at MIT. That's always one thing I gained there. And I mean, yeah, I think, you know, it's the path that I took. And, you know, I really did learn a lot. And, you know, besides learning neuroscience in my PhD, I also learned just how to think. I think that's the main value of PhDs, is that you learn critical thinking, which is incredibly valuable as a life skill in general. And, you know, the relationships I made there, everything I learned. And, you know, some of the neuroscience bleeds into my fiction as well. You know, I have a book about memory loss, and other books where I have to make cultures from scratch. And so knowing what I do about sociology and social psychology really helps there. So, and I mean, I just had so much fun at grad school with friends and stuff. So I can't regret it.
So what did your family think about you, you know, leaving that behind and embarking on a career as a writer?
That's a great question, especially for, you know, an Asian person. I think, so, you know, my parents always knew that I loved writing, but they kind of nudged me towards something a little more practical, with good reason. You know, it is very hard to make a living and make money as a writer. I think, you know, but as I gradually moved on in science and got more advanced, you know, they could tell that it wasn't the right path for me, and I could tell. And so it was a very gradual process where by the time I sold my first book and graduated, you know, it was pretty clear to everyone that this was the right path for me. And then at that point, they were supportive of me moving on.
It probably didn't hurt that you sold a book right away.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely helped too.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, real talk, as far as writers go, you know, it didn't hurt that I was married at that point to someone with a steady job, too, which is, you know, we don't talk about money much as writers, but it really is is helpful for artists.
Of course.
So this is really you wrote from the heart, and you can tell by the you can tell.
Thank you.
By the way this book, you know, develops, that you it was from the heart. And I really enjoyed it because of that.
Yeah, there were a lot of tears while I was writing and while I was revising and when I got the pictures for the first time. So it was a very emotional process the entire time.
Well, I would say that your illustrator really caught your feelings and was able to do her job very well in illustrating too.
Yeah, it was really beautiful. I remember when I first got the email with the illustrations, I was in bed. I had just gotten up, and you know, I opened it up, and I just immediately started crying. It was just so emotional seeing all the images. And the funny thing was, I was at my parents' house on vacation at that time, so I just forwarded it to my mom while I was still in bed. And then later I got out, and my mom was reading the book on her iPad to my daughter. And so I kind of passed them. I go into the next room, come back, and my mom had completely broken down in tears.
Aww.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm definitely going to give your book to my grandchildren. Who have been, let's see, the oldest is 11. He's been to Taiwan twice. And the youngest is 8, and she's only been once. And in fact, you know, I think that the last time they went, which was a few years ago, on the way over there, their great grandmother passed away while they were on the way over. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, would you like to read the book to us, Livia?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's such a short book. I think I can just read through the whole thing.
All right.
All right. So it is I Dream of Popo by Livia Blackburn and Julia Kuo. I dream with Popo as she rocks me in her arms. She sings, Bei Bei Xing, Bei Bei Gan. In my heart I hear, my baby, my heart, my baby, my love. I walk with Popo in the park, squeezing her finger in my chubby palm. When I wobble, she holds me up. She pushes me on the swing and lifts me to hear the birds sing. I bow to Popo on New Year's Day. She asks if I've been good and gives me a red envelope. Then she fries up crispy, gooey, sweet New Year's cakes, so hot they almost burn my tongue. I sit with Popo, and she shows me where I'm going to live. Here's Taiwan, so tiny, surrounded by blue. There is San Diego, far, far away. You will learn and see many new things, she says. I wave at Popo before I board my flight with Mama and Baba. The airplane thrums like the biggest cat I've ever seen. Fly safely, Popo says. Call me every week and tell me about your adventures. I think of Popo as I meet new friends, kids with hair of every color and skin of every shade. They say hi. I say ni hao. I talk to Popo from across the sea. I'm learning a new language, I say, and I miss your dumplings. I'll make them for you when you visit, she says. I draw Popo at my new school. Below the picture I write, my grandma, though it feels strange to call her that. I learn other words, too. Dumplings, motorcycle, school bus. Mm-hmm. After a while, the words form easier on my tongue. I hug Popo when I come back to visit. Now ni hao is what feels strange in my mouth. Other words, too, are hard to catch, like fish in a deep well. I asked Mama why I can't talk to Popo like before. You can still hug her as tight as before, she says. I do. Popo hugs me even tighter. I eat with Popo in her house, surrounded by the fragrance of guihua blossoms. She cooks my favorite dumplings dipped in soy sauce and sesame oil. Her house looks smaller than I remember, but everything smells the same. Popo looks smaller, too. Her hair is more white. When I board the plane again, Popo packs me dumplings to eat on the way. I wonder how she'll look when I see her again. I pray for Popo when we hear she is sick. I sing to her as she lies in bed, frail under heavy blankets. I wish I could reach across the ocean and hold her up. She whispers to me in a voice soft as birdsong, Bei Bei Xing, my baby, my heart. It's a promise and a kiss. I dream of Popo coming to me while I sleep. I say, Ni hao. She says, hello. I say, Wo ai ni. She says, I love you too. A breeze brushes my face, rich with the scent of guihua. I tell Popo about my adventures, and she smiles.
Very nice.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, Livia, you've written, I can see why you were crying. Yeah, and while your mother was crying. You've written 4 young adult novels and then this children's book. And I think a lot of times people think, oh, writing a children's book is easy because it's so short. But how, in terms of getting it right, how is it a lot easier than writing your young adult fantasy novels?
So in terms of time, it definitely takes less time. I'd say in terms of difficulty, it's a different kind of difficulty. So, you know, I think of writing a novel as building a ship. You know, you're using these big planks and you're cutting things and you're moving them around, and, you know, it's a really large scale project. And whereas making a picture book, it's like making a ship in a bottle. So you've got your tweezers, you've got your little tiny pieces, and, you know, everything is so small. You can see it all. But the work is just so much more delicate. You know, every single word you think about, and also, you know, bottles are small, so you have to figure out how to fit the whole thing in there too, which is, you know, not incredibly easy either. So, you know, it's different.
Wow. That's a great metaphor for it, like building a ship in the bottle. Now, Julia, have you ever wanted to write children's books as well as illustrate them?
You know, I don't think it was something that I had aspired to, but it's kind of the way things happened is that I actually have my debut book coming out next year.
Oh!
And after that, I'll have another book that I'm also writing myself, too.
Oh, good.
Can you tell us something about the book that's coming out?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's called Let's Do Everything and Nothing, and it's about a little girl and her mom going on these amazing outdoors adventures and, you know, climbing mountains and doing all these things that you would think are so remarkable and just completely adventurous, but also at the end of the day coming back and being able to find peace and contentment at home, relaxing and just doing nothing together.
How is it different for you illustrating your own words as opposed to someone else's?
It's really bizarre. I have to say, I really love illustrating other people's stories. There is something about the problem-solving aspect of it. It's less personal and more analytical. Like, yes, there will always be a big part of me in every picture book that I draw, but the goal, like the main assignment for me is to bring Livia's story to life, right? And so, you know, like I get to work on interpreting her words and thinking about what the best way to translate those words into visuals are. But writing and illustrating my own, it's a completely different beast in that I have so much control. It's almost overwhelming, you know? And so I think that ideally, there is a better marriage of words and image, and I can kind of craft everything myself and make it exactly what I want. And this book is going to be 100% me, which is a little bit scary and almost feels vulnerable. But on the other hand, along with being vulnerable, it makes me realize that I still have a lot to learn as a writer and also as an illustrator. So I think the task is a lot. It's not just times two. I think it feels a lot bigger and more challenging.
I can see that. I can see that. And Livia, have you ever had any aspirations to in visual art?
it's really great that you asked that. You can probably tell by my reaction. I have a few stories I can share. So for my first or second book, I needed a map for my novel. And so I just drew one out in paint. You know, it looked like a 3-year-old scrawl. And at the end, we were giving the book to the copy editor, so I emailed the map along, you know, just in case it helps, because the copy editor checks for consistency. And my agent, who had been CC'd on that email, replies and says, "You know, I really admire your thoroughness. Somehow, I don't think these maps will make the end papers." I can thank them. and recently, I actually I had an idea for another project that. Not for a book, for a video actually, that had no commercial potential. So I was, it needed illustration, but, you know, I was going to have to do it myself if anyone. So I was, attempting to draw stick figures on the iPad, and, those will need further work as well.
I see. Now, do your young adult books have any illustrations in them? Because sometimes they do.
Not these. These okay. are just the cover.
Okay. I just realized today is sort of the main day of Chinese New Year.
Yeah.
Happy Lunar New Year.
Yeah.
So do you still celebrate that here in the U.S.? Yeah. How do you celebrate it?
Usually in non-pandemic times, we would be having dinner the day before the Lunar New Year. And then there's the red envelopes.
Explain those red envelopes, because that is part of the story.
Right, yeah. So red envelopes, they're envelopes usually with money inside that adults give to children on Chinese New Year's, and you know, it seems like a great deal when you're young, but then what they don't tell you is that when you get married, it flips so that now you have to give the red envelopes to your parents, and usually by then the denominations are much bigger than what they give the kids. And Julia had a funny story the other day about what happened to the red envelopes that her parents gave her.
Oh yeah, so you know, your aunties and your uncles are giving these little packets of money to you when you're 5 and 6 years old and 9 and 10, you know, all throughout your childhood. And my parents would take the red envelope and they would say, "Okay, Julia, we're going to take this and put this in your special bank account." And I'd be like, "Great." And so later when I got older, I remembered the special bank account, because I knew that's where all those red envelopes had been going this entire time. And I asked them about it, and their response was, "What bank account?" And so,
oh,
you know,
my.
it turns out this is a very, like, I posted about this the other day, and it seems as if it's a common occurrence that this happens to many children, and maybe for good reason. But it was still a shock.
I bet. Now, I understand that not just any money will do, that you're supposed to have crisp new bills. Is that was that your experience?
Yes. Crisp new bills, and if possible, Maria, did you get denominations of 8?
No, I think all my aunties were just kind of gave like 20s or like hundreds if they were, you know, really generous.
So, did you say something about denominations of 8?
Yeah, so 8 is a very lucky number, and so I would get, you know, like $8 or like 80 Taiwanese dollars, or no, it would be 88 Taiwanese dollars.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's like very little U.S. money. It sounds like not, but it's not.
And are there other, what are some of the other traditions around the Lunar New Year?
So, you know, it's actually a 2-week festival. So it's marked by little smaller holidays within those 2 weeks. Like there is one to kick off the launch and there is one to end it. And so when I go back to Taiwan, I usually go at this time of year and I can kind of see the festivities. And a lot of them I'm not even completely sure about, but There are different hallmarks of the time. So you're supposed to, for instance, eat really long noodles on the first day, and that's to signify a long life. Another thing people might be familiar with is the lighting of these huge paper lanterns that float up into the sky. And that's actually something happens at the very end of the Lunar New Year festival. And, you know, these are all old traditions, but there are also some new ones mixed in. For example, in Taiwan, you know, fireworks are just set everywhere. Like, they're set from sidewalks and, you know, people's backyards. And they're so prevalent that one town decided to create this firework area that people walk through. So normal people will put on their scooter helmet, they'll put on layers of jackets and coats to protect themselves, and they'll like run through these fireworks. And like, I think a lot of people have gotten injured because it's very dangerous, but it's still continues to this day.
I mean, like, what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, really.
right. So definitely a modern thing that is not traditional.
Is it true that the Chinese invented fireworks?
That's a good question. I don't know. I've heard they invented gunpowder, but
yeah, I've heard that too.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking.
Yeah. So, Livia, do you have any other traditions, New Year traditions that you'd like to share?
I mean, there's always, like, there's lion dances that are parades and stuff. We don't always go to see them, but they are fun to see at banquets and so forth. And I was just talking to my mom. We don't do this, but traditionally, I think the first day you're supposed to have dinner with the husband's family, and then the second day you go back to the bride's family to celebrate.
Now, I think of these, and maybe this is what you're talking about, the line dances, where it's like this long dragon with everyone holding up part of it, and it looks like it's moving along. Is that part of this?
Yeah, so there's, they have like tiger are lion puppets and dragon puppets, and it'll usually be martial arts dancers, and they're just jumping around, and the dragon is flying around, and sometimes they'll feed oranges to the lions, and the lions they'll take it and spit out the peel. It's just a lot of fun.
Now, in I Dream of Popo, there's references to food, which is something that is often very important part of family traditions having to do with food. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the traditional foods and what they signify for you?
So there's New Year's cake, which is called Nian Gao. It's kind of a glutinous rice cake. And so it's a play on words, because Nian is also the word for sticky. It's a homonym. And it's also the word for year. And so those can be sweet or savory, and that you can stir fry them, or you can pan fry the sweet ones dipped in egg. You often have fish and noodles to symbolize long life. Let's see, Julia, can you think of any others?
I think that it also goes along with what gets put on the traditional altar. I think that's like another part of the New Year, is that some of the food is prepared for us to eat, and then some of it is prepared to be kind of put on the altar to deities. And so I think that I can't remember exactly what makes it from one table to the other, but a lot of times we would kind of like set aside an extra portion of the foods that Lily was talking about for the end of the night, when you would go to the altar and like pay respects.
Well, in the book, dumplings were mentioned quite often, because they were a favorite of this little girl, and her grandmother made dumplings. And then, I thought that was
interesting. I love Chinese dumplings.
They are tasty.
Yeah. Do you still make them?
Not so much anymore. I think the last time we made it was at a family reunion where everybody got around the table. That's always it's a really fun group activity to have, dumpling ingredients and everybody just wrapping them. Nowadays, we've been pretty busy.
Yeah, plus COVID makes it harder for anyone to get together, for sure. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guests today are Livia Blackburn, author of I Dream of Popo, and Julia Kuo, who is the illustrator. Now, in the letter that I got about your book, it mentions shared that I Dream of Popo is a collaboration, of course, and shared experiences of the book's author, illustrator, and editor.
Yes.
So you want to tell me a little bit about the editor's role in this?
Yeah, so our editor, Connie, is she is also Taiwanese-American, and I think I was really lucky to find her, I think, for this book, because she read it and she just automatically, she saw her own story in it too. And, she had such a personal connection to it. She really did a wonderful job of guiding us, especially in writing our author's notes and illustrator notes, of kind of getting us to think through the immigration experience and just put, the important themes in there. And I know that, like, Julia working with Connie also had, like, it was helpful in several ways, right?
Yeah. So, when I work with Connie, the editor, and the team, they're always giving feedback about, how the images advance the plot and how they'll look in the book, making notes about how images might fall into the gutter and so on. But it was really amazing to have Connie there to also understand the cultural component, where we could discuss whether or not certain things were appropriate to the book, or even better yet, not have to discuss them. So, for example, there's a lot of little things in the book, house slippers by the door in one, or in the kitchen scene. There's like a huge cleaver on the kitchen table, and then also a 20-pound bag of rice on the floor. And she never questioned any of these. And I know that that's because these are elements that are kind of shared among all Taiwanese families, no matter where they are in the world. Like, we always have that oversized bag of rice, and we use the cleaver to cut everything. It doesn't matter how small the food is. Like, it's always the cleaver. And so I thought that was just so, so wonderful, knowing that she was just on the same page and understood what I was trying to do.
You know, one of the issues in publishing today is, are people, minorities represented in what's available in children's literature, what's being published, children, young adult, and even adult novels. And we interviewed two sisters yesterday, Maritza and Maika Mulit, who write books with African-American protagonists. And so we were talking about that, how important it is for children to be able to see someone like them. Is that part of why you wanted to write this children's book?
So it was part of the reason, but I think, to be honest, I didn't really realize the importance of representation in literature until after I wrote it. When I was writing it, I wanted to tell my own story. And it was just, something that I wanted for myself. But it was after releasing it, and I kind of knew intellectually that, yeah, we should have diverse books, and I supported it in like a intellectual way. But I didn't truly realize the impact until after it came out. Because, since then I've just heard from so many readers, and with really heartfelt messages, people saying, oh, is this what it feels like to be represented in books? Like, it's never happened before. And one reviewer said, I've never been more known by a book than this one. And, it just seeing all of that, like seeing the reaction, it's really humbling.
Wow. As an author of young adult novels, was it easier for you to find a publisher for a children's book than it would for somebody who is just starting out? Or is it still difficult because, you know, you're expected to be writing young adult novels?
Well, I think it was easier in the sense that I already had an agent, so I didn't have to do that. And my agent already had connections to editors. I don't think my young adult record helped or hurt my picture, my ability to sell a picture book in any way, just because, you know, I there's hardly any overlap in the audience. And actually, my agent didn't do picture books before we sold this one. So, I mean, I'm very grateful to him that, you know, I gave him the manuscript, and he was like, okay, we'll try. And thankfully, most young adult editors also do picture books. Well, most young adult and MG editors also do picture books. So, you know, his connection, he already had the connections to the picture book editors.
Oh, that's good. How hard was it for you to find the editor agent in the first place back when you were first starting out?
I was pretty fortunate in that case too. And my story is somewhat funny because I actually, I planned to self-publish Midnight Thief. I was writing at the time where Amazon Kindle was getting really popular. Joe Conrad had a blog, and Amanda Hawking was, making millions, and Barry Eisler had turned down a publishing deal to self-publish. And so at that point, that was my plan. I was going to do that. And I told my writing group, and they were supportive. But then they said, you know, why don't you just query some agents? Just in case. And so I thought, okay. And I did what I don't recommend what people do, which is, you know, in my second to last round of edits, I basically shotgunned my query to a whole lot. And I didn't do any research. I just went to Publishers Marketplace, and I just, you know, sent queries down the line of young adult deal makers, because, you know, it wasn't really plan A for me anyways. But I ended up getting offers of representation, and I think what ended up changing my mind about going the traditional path was that these agents, we talked about vision for the book, and they all had really great editorial suggestions, and I started to think that, oh, you know, working with a publishing house, with a editor in a publishing house would help me become a better writer and, you know, create a better product, at least at that point in my career. And I do think it's true. You know, the book that I went out with that was published was much, much better than the version I had put on submission.
You know, I'm glad that you said that, because that's been my experience too in terms of the books that we receive, you know, the queries to be on Writers' Voices, that, you know, we're happy to take self-published authors, but I often feel like the book wasn't really quite done. The book that got published wasn't quite done, finished.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I've definitely read books by self-published authors that have been fantastic. And so I think it really just depends on the author, you know? So like in traditional publishing, at least you do have, you know, other people kind of nudging you with the story. If you're self-publishing, you're kind of responsible for all that yourself. So you have to make the right decisions.
The other real difference that I see between the traditionally published books that we see and the self-published is there's something about the visual, and Julia, this is something that maybe you can comment on, the actual, the way the type is laid out on the page, the color of the paper, there's something about the visual presentation that I can almost always spot if it's been self-published.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that speaks to the fact that there are people whose entire jobs at publishing companies are to make sure the book looks good. So like the designer who lays out the type and chooses the paper, looks at the color proofs carefully, and then gets another set of proofs. You know, these things don't happen with self-publishing. It's really just kind of a one-stop shop. So I think it should look different because there are so many more resources going into the production value of this book.
Well, that yeah. makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I can speak to that a little bit as well, because I've actually self-published some things as well, just depending on the project. And so, for example, my cover for Midnight Thief, they worked with a professional designer, and the designer actually made clay models of lion heads to take pictures of it and digitally make it into a really stunning cover for the book. And, you know, I for my self-published books, I just can't afford that, you know, so I work with artists to do, Photoshop of stock art images, and those are really beautiful as well. And, you know, I don't want to draw generalizations because, you know, I've definitely seen, like, kind of cringeworthy traditional covers as well. But there is it's nice to have that kind of big budget and that team behind it. On the flip side, you know, sometimes, you know, with traditional publishing, if they give you a cover that you don't love, you know, you might be stuck with it. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just add to the one last thing, what Livia said about the budget? You know, there's also just the idea of economies of scale. So if you're self-publishing, maybe if you're lucky, you could put up enough to create 5,000 copies. But that means that your copies are going to be so expensive. If you could print 10,000, then they'd be a little bit cheaper. And so I think that's something that the publishers will always have over self-publishing, is that they're able to create such volume and to get the price down. And then that way they're able to make each quality a little bit higher, each copy a little bit higher quality than if you're just making a very, very small batch.
Of course, with ebooks, that kind of flips things. The appearance is not nearly as important, I guess, on an ebook. You don't have the feel. You don't have the tactile feel of the page and so forth, and hardly even look at the cover. At least I don't very much when it's an ebook. Livia, before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you about your story writing workshops.
Ah, yes. Right. So, I think a few years ago, I had a friend who had high school kids, and she just approached me and said, "Oh, do you want to do a summer writing camp for a bunch of high school students?" And so, it sounded fun. So I did it, and we had a week-long camp, I think 3 hours a day, where we went through the entire process, beginning to end, of writing a short story. And then afterwards, I took all my lesson plans from those and kind of packaged it together into a story writing workshop lesson plan. So that they are PowerPoints and PDFs. And so those are available on Teachers Pay Teachers. There's a link to them from my website. So it's meant for teachers and educators to teach their own creative writing units.
And then you have a special one about Hogwarts.
Yes. Yeah, that one. Yeah, all my lesson plans are all from kind of workshops that I've done. And so that one was for another science fiction workshop. And that one is just a short one where it takes people through a world-building exercise where they create a kind of Hogwarts-like school in their own hometown.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
It was fun.
So, Julia, do you have some advice? We're just about out of time, but do you have some advice for someone who would like to break into illustrating books?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing I could say is to be prolific and make as much work as you can, but particularly create the type of work that you would want to be hired for, or the stories that you would want to illustrate. You know, the people that hire you may not necessarily be artists themselves. And so it really just helps to be able to see those concrete examples. Like, if you love dinosaurs, then make sure your portfolio is full of them and that people can keep you in mind when they, you know, a year later are holding that dinosaur manuscript and they're like, "Oh, there's this girl that just draws these amazing dinosaurs."
And Livia, for someone who wants to break into either young adult or picture book writing, do you have some advice?
I think it's just write as much as you can, and find people around your level who enjoy the same types of stories that you do to critique your writing. I'm still with the same critique group I was with when I started Midnight Thief 10 years ago. And you know, it's super helpful to have that support structure and just to improve your craft.
Mm. Well, thank you. And Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
Yes, I do. You know, I want you to, all of you, to stop and think a minute. Grandmother, grandfather, grandchildren, those words. My favorite thing to do is at church when I see one of my friends holding a grandchild is to walk up and say, you know what grandchildren are? And they'll say no. And I say, God's gift to us for getting old.
Or to make up for all the misery our children caused us. But
revenge on your children.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Livia and Julia.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.